Hello there. Today is Wednesday, August 29th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, tributes and memorials continue as preparations begin for the funeral of Senator John McCain.
If you want to help me, join the march. If you want to help the country, be more like John McCain. I believe there's a little John McCain in all of us.
McCain's sense of honor is highlighting the growing divisiveness in the United States. A UN investigative report concludes that Myanmar's military committed genocide, gang rape, and sexual slavery. Also ahead, thousands of mourners pay their respects to singer Aretha Franklin. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump has broken his public silence on the late Senator John McCain 2 days after his death and after an outcry from veterans groups over the president's response and that of the White House. At an event celebrating evangelical leaders, Trump offered appreciation for Senator McCain, who was also a former prisoner of war shot down during the Vietnam War.
We very much appreciate everything that Senator McCain has done for our country.
Before Monday's comment, Trump ignored reporters on cameras, questions about McCain, leaving many to wonder if he had not yet overcome McCain's crucial vote to block an effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Trump seemingly yielded to pressure from veterans groups to lower flags at the White House to have staff in honor of McCain, fueled speculation the president may be holding on to some animosity toward McCain, known for his speak your mind maverick style. Before he died, McCain wrote a farewell letter to the nation, which was read by McCain family spokesman Rick Davis.
We weaken our greatness when we confuse our patriotism with tribal rivalries. We weaken it when we hide behind walls rather than tear them down. Do not despair of our present difficulties. We believe always in the promise and greatness of America, because nothing is inevitable here.
Tributes were continuing publicly and in Congress, where McCain's close friend and ally, Lindsey Graham, gave a tearful speech.
He had wanted to be president. He was prepared to be president, but it was not his to have. And I remember, above all else, the speech he gave that night. John taught us how to lose. When you go throughout the world, people remember his concession speech as much as anything else. There are so many countries where you can't afford to lose because they kill you. And John said that night, President Obama is now my president. So he healed the nation at a time he was hurt.
And Defense Secretary James Mattis also gave strong praise and respect for the Arizona senator.
My deepest condolences to his family for the loss of a man who represented all the ideals America stands for. Senator John McCain was a man who served his country honorably as a naval officer, as a defiant prisoner of war, standing with his brothers in arms until all returned home together, and as a leader in Congress, including as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Before his death, McCain requested that Trump not attend any services for him, but Vice President Mike Pence, with whom McCain served in Congress, will attend a service Friday in Congress, and three Trump cabinet members will attend services later this week. McCain will lie in state in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol prior to his funeral on Sunday. He will be buried at his alma mater, the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Meanwhile, the death of John McCain and the ongoing tensions he had with President Trump have highlighted the larger and growing divisions in America. Our guest now is Michael Hutchins, author of the new book, Irreconcilable Politics, Our Rights Under a Just Government. Thank you for being with us. Your book really gets to the root of why Americans are so divided. So please tell us, why, in your view, does this seem so evident?
There could be many, many reasons, but the heart of it is we have different ideologies. You know, we have different morals and different worldviews, and no amount of discussion or sharing or debating has reconciled these views. And we've had them for a long time, and probably as you get more and more people, you probably have more and more different views. So I think that's the fundamental view. We have fundamentally different ideologies. Globally, it's even more, you know, even broader ideology.
What about fact?
Well, you know, there are facts. world's round and there's a moon out there. So there are definitely facts. The problem, I think, with government rules and laws and so forth is that human interaction is so complicated that the implications of all that, I think, is impossible for everybody to fathom. And so someone may have the right answer. They're just unable to convince everybody else they're right. And that's sort of our view. If everyone has, how do you prove that people are right and wrong? And science, so you can do that. I think with laws, given people's different ideologies, I think it's impossible. Normally, it's like, you disagree with me, you must be wrong. But if I'm unable to convince you that you're wrong, how do I really know I'm right?
We know the differences are always going to be there. They always have been there. But have you ever seen such a division in our country as we do now?
I think we've always had ideological differences. But I think that you have more. It seems to be more now, I think, for a number of reasons. One, I think we have a fairly powerful federal government. And so even though we have states, I think we have the federal government able to pass laws and enforce laws domestically so that everyone has to basically, for the most part, conform to one set of laws. And they fundamentally disagree. Some people fundamentally disagree with a lot of these laws and rules and policies.
It seems, though, people are so dug in right now that they're so divided that they can't really even hear the other side.
I think that's what happens when you feel like you're only, that you're forced to live under someone else's rules, and especially rules you fundamentally think are wrong. And especially when the only way to really make decisions that we have is through majority voting. And majority voting doesn't let you reveal how intensely that you feel about a law. Your vote counts just like somebody else's vote that doesn't care that much. And I think that's very frustrating to a lot of people. They would intensely care about some of the rules and laws that they're actually forced to live under. And so they get very angry.
What do you think the solution is to try to bridge some of the divides so that we can actually, instead of just constantly clashing, getting more things done in this country instead of constantly bickering?
Well, I think the traditional answer is debate. Public debate is really sort of the heart of probably the U.S. Constitution. And the theory I think there is if we debate it, we'll get all the answers out, and therefore hopefully we can come up with an answer that is the best answer at the time. I think the issue is it takes a lot for people to actually fundamentally agree with, even with a lot of discussion on the fundamental laws that they should be under. So I think the only conclusion is, just like there can't be one global government because of all the different ideologies, I think at least for people that are probably the broad base of people in the United States, I think that you need a federalist type of government, and one that's different than the one we have, and one that's different than we've probably ever seen. It's one where you have a very powerful central government that represents all the people, but doesn't have very many domestic authorities. And domestic authorities are ones that we can agree to. And there's some that we can agree to, but they're not a lot. And therefore, the ones we disagree with, we should probably have other kinds of domestic governments. And those domestic governments, I think, are much broader than what we've historically had. Could be a big regional government like the Northeast or something, where they follow like Democratic Party policy or the European Union type policy. But then there could be another region of the government or the region of the country that follows more libertarian policies. And that government could actually be federalist itself. And so it allows a lot of local decision making that they think is in the best interest. And these domestic governments could all work together. And I think that gives people, and the argument in the book is, that gives people the highest chance of living under the ideology and laws that they think are best and having the highest chance of living the life that they value the most.
All right, Michael Hutchins, he is the author of the new book, Irreconcilable Politics, Under Our Rights, Under a Just Government. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump expands his criticism of Google to include Facebook and Twitter. Trump's rollback of a clean power plan means support in coal country. A new report finds nearly 3,000 deaths in Puerto Rico linked to Hurricane Maria. And Peru declares an emergency as Venezuelans flee a crisis at home. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. UN investigators, completing a year-long process of interviews and analysis, concluded Monday that the commander-in-chief of the military in Myanmar, also known as Burma, along with five other generals, are responsible for mass killings, gang rapes, sexual slavery, and abductions targeting the Rohingya Muslim community. They said the intent was genocidal and called for their prosecution. Christopher Sadati was among the investigators.
There is no smoking gun. We do not have a copy of a direct order that says undertake genocide tomorrow, please. But that is the case almost universally when cases of genocide have gone before the courts. The intent has to be inferred from the surrounding circumstances. The two relevant things for us are first that the kinds of circumstances are of a nature, the kinds of circumstances that in other cases have been found to constitute or enable the inference of intent to be found. And second, in Myanmar there is a very clear chain of command, and there is no doubt in our minds whatsoever that what we saw happen in Rakhine as a whole would not have happened without it firstly being within the knowledge of the senior military leadership, and secondly, under their effective control.
The UN panel also criticized de facto civilian leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi for failing to use her moral authority to protect the Rohingya. They also took aim at the social media network Facebook for allowing its platform to be used in Myanmar to spread hate and incite violence. Facebook responded by blocking 20 officials and organizations found by the UN panel to be complicit in rights abuses. Nicholas Farrelly is an associate dean in the College of Asia Pacific at Australian National University and a longtime Myanmar expert. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the UN report represents an important contribution to the growing international outrage over the security crackdown in Rakhine State.
These are the most serious accusations that can be made by an investigative body of the type that's been convened under United Nations auspices. And so we all need to consider what we do next. We had worried for the past year that the many allegations that had emerged about the Myanmar government and army's activities in northern Rakhine State would require of all of us some much more significant investment. And the United Nations has now left us in no doubt that the events of 2017 in Myanmar are going to force all of us into considering exactly what needs to be done to hold those to account who have allegedly committed these heinous crimes, and then perhaps to put Myanmar back on a path towards much greater inclusion of those who have been persecuted and excluded with such violence.
Well, these investigators also blame Myanmar's de facto civilian leader, Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, for failing to use her, quote, moral authority to protect civilians.
It's damning. What we've seen over the past year is that there were great failings, including at the very highest level in the State Councillor's office, and the United Nations hasn't pulled its punches, and this is going to have very significant consequences. Aung San Suu Kyi's personal reputation was, at least among serious analysts, already shredded by what had happened last year, and this is just a further nail in the coffin of what has been a most dramatic and horrendous downward spiral for Aung San Suu Kyi and for the government that she leads.
The UN investigators criticized Facebook, the social media platform, which became Myanmar's dominant social network despite having no employees. Their Facebook responding, announcing it's blocking 20 Myanmar officials and organizations found by the UN panel to have committed or enabled serious human rights abuses.
Some would say that that's too little too late, given the way that Facebook was weaponized, particularly last year in Myanmar's Buddhist-Muslim communal conflicts. On the other hand, it's still a brave move, given the sorts of pressures that Facebook is under to be a beacon for free speech and all the rest, to come out so directly and to target those that it obviously considers have been utilizing its service for purposes that aren't within the spirit of Facebook or its now worldwide moral, political, and strategic and cultural mandate. And so taking the senior general and other top officials offline is, I guess, another signal of just how seriously the world is going to start treating Myanmar.
The U.S. is preparing its own report on the Rohingya crackdown, with a State Department spokesman calling the U.N. findings further evidence of widespread rights abuses by Myanmar forces. Washington has imposed sanctions on members of the security forces, with more being considered. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, marking the one-year anniversary of the crackdown last week, reaffirmed the view that it was ethnic cleansing, and the U.S. will hold accountable those responsible. Meanwhile, U.N. investigators have also accused Yemen, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, as well as Houthi rebels in Yemen, of committing indiscriminate attacks and heinous acts, including torture and forced disappearances that may constitute war crimes. The 41-page report by the group of eminent experts on Yemen covers the period from September 2014 to June 2018. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report paints a bleak picture of what civilians have suffered at the hands of all warring parties, especially since March 2015. That is when the Saudi-led coalition entered the war in support of the Yemeni government. The report blames coalition airstrikes for most of the civilian casualties. During the past 3.5 years, the United Nations reports 6,600 civilians have been killed and nearly 10,600 injured. UN expert Charles Garraway says individuals in the government of Yemen and the coalition, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, may have conducted attacks in violation of the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution that may amount to war crimes.
And also acts that may amount to war crimes, including cruel treatment and torture, outrages upon personal dignity, rape, and conscripting or enlisting children under the age of 15, or using them to participate actively in hostilities.
Garraway says the group of experts has documented similar crimes committed by rebel Houthi forces. He says arbitrary detention is widespread throughout the country, as is ill treatment and torture in some facilities. He says the scale of sexual violence and rape is appalling and must be investigated.
Children are the most vulnerable. Poverty, coupled with violence and insecurity, render them defenseless and exposed to exploitation and abuse by parties to the conflict.
The group of experts says it has not received any response from the parties to the report. The Reuters news agency reports the Saudi-led coalition has referred the document to its legal team for review. The investigators say they have drawn up a confidential list of individuals who may be responsible for international crimes. This list has been submitted to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA VOA's International Edition continues. Musician Jamie Turner chose an unconventional career path by becoming a glass harpist. He plays music with glasses filled with water. He uses his fingertips to rub the rim of the glasses to create a range of musical tones. VOA's Deborah Block watched Turner play the glass harp in Alexandria, Virginia, where people seemed to be awestruck by the sounds he created.
Glass harpist Jamie Turner spreads his music to visitors in Alexandria, Virginia, with this popular classical tune, Ode to Joy by Beethoven. Turner has been showcasing his music here for more than 25 years. A lot of tourists come to visit this historic town outside Washington, many from overseas.
I've never heard something like this before. I think it's fantastic.
I think it's like a really different way to play music, and it seems difficult to do it and to remember like which cup sounds which way.
Turner, who is 78 years old, began playing the glass harp 50 years ago. Although he also plays other instruments, the glass harp is his passion.
The instrument that really caught my imagination was the sound of glass when I heard my dad playing a glass around the dining room table when I was 6 years old.
Turner sets up 60 ordinary stemmed glasses on a soundboard, anchored with rubber bands, which keeps them from breaking. He tunes each glass to a different pitch by filling them with distilled water. As Turner rubs his dampened fingers around the rims, the smaller bowls produce higher pitches, while the larger ones resonate deeper tones.
The more water is in the glass, the lower the pitch.
Some visitors enjoyed the opportunity to play the biggest glasses.
I didn't know glass was actually like an instrument. I didn't know it made that much sound.
The glass harp was popular in the 1700s, when classical composers like Mozart wrote music specifically for the instrument. Turner plays all kinds of music. Including this popular Chinese tune.
Very amazing.
The glass harpist has been able to make a living as a performer and has even played with top U.S. orchestras. But with so few people playing the glass harp, Turner is hoping the next generation will keep the instrument alive.
I think it's gaining in popularity. A lot of people have seen me on YouTube, and I'm very pleased that it will continue. People can't help but smile when they hear it.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Hundreds of mourners poured into Detroit's Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History to pay their respects this week to Aretha Franklin, who died August 16th of pancreatic cancer at the age of 76. The two-day viewing was part of a week of commemorations for the music legend. The Wright Museum is a cultural landmark in Detroit where Franklin grew up and spent most of her life. The AP's Julie Walker has details.
Fans of Aretha Franklin yelled for her as the Queen of Soul's gold casket made its way from an old-fashioned white hearse into the museum. The line to get in stretches around the building, with some fans getting there yesterday to make sure they have the chance to pay their respects to Franklin, who died last week after battling cancer. Following the 2 days of public viewing, a musical tribute will be held on Thursday and then a private funeral on Friday.
Well, the regal presence of Aretha Franklin exuded in life was also captured at her viewing on Tuesday, where she was dressed completely in red, including high-heeled pumps, proving, as one person put it, that she was diva to the end.
Lines were moving very fast. I was not prepared for what I was going to see. I thought we were going through the museum. But it's Aretha. She's beautiful. They took care of her beautifully. And she's such a powerful presence in all our lives, as you can see from the turnout. You know, there were people crying, but what I see most was respect. And that's something that's like a moniker attached to Aretha, respect.
Mixed emotions, you know, and it was sad. It was sad. She's such a great lady, and she's so talented. And there she was. It touched me deeply.
Fans walked past the casket, some in tears. One woman blew a kiss to Franklin, who was surrounded by massive arrangements of roses of different hues. For all the formality, though, her niece, Sabrina Owen, said the viewings are intended to be welcoming and accessible for her legions of fans who, Owen said, Franklin respected and understood that, if not for them, she wouldn't be who she is. Franklin had strong loyalty to her family and fans to her last days.
Ain't no way for me to love you.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is determined to take a comprehensive approach to the Iranian regime because of the wide-ranging nature of Iran's malign activities, including violent and destabilizing behavior toward the United States, its allies, and the Iranian people themselves. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo recently announced the creation of a special group of foreign affairs professionals at the State Department called the Iran Action Group to implement and coordinate a comprehensive approach. In announcing the IAG, as it is called, Secretary Pompeo noted that since the United States withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, which failed to restrain Iran's nuclear progress or its campaigns of violence, President Donald Trump has instituted a campaign of pressure, deterrence, and solidarity with the long-suffering Iranian people.
Our hope is that one day soon we can reach a new agreement with Iran, but we must see major changes in the regime's behavior both inside and outside of its borders. The Iranian people and the world are demanding that Iran finally act like a normal nation.
Special Representative for Iran Brian Hook will lead the Iran Action Group. He told reporters that the team will continue to work with allies and other nations around the world to build the broadest level of international support for the approach the U.S. is taking, building on areas of agreement and working to find consensus on areas of disagreement.
When you look at the range of Iranian threats, especially around missiles and cyber, maritime aggression, terrorism, these are concerns of other nations. The United States is not alone in that regard.
Special Representative Hook noted that if the Iranian regime demonstrates changes in its behavior, then the president is prepared to engage in dialogue in order to find solutions. But, he said, the sanctions relief, the reestablishment of full diplomatic and commercial relations with the United States, and economic cooperation with the United States can only begin after we see that the Iranian regime is serious about changing its behavior.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.